From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The life of Langston Hughes on this edition of Fresh Air, with Hughes biographer Arnold Rampersad. Rampersad's two-volume biography chronicles the life and work of one of Black America's greatest writers. Rhys Chatham composes music that has the repetitive patterns associated with minimalism and the drive and volume of hard rock. Coming up, Chatham tells us about writing new age music for heavy metal fans. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of compositions by pianist Bud Powell, performed by Herb Robertson's brass ensemble. And Elvis returns for an exclusive Fresh Air interview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? That's from one of Langston Hughes' most quoted poems, Harlem. Langston Hughes is generally acknowledged as the most prominent and most popular Afro-American poet of the century. Hughes championed racial consciousness as a source of inspiration for Black artists, and many Black writers have credited him with changing their self-images as Blacks. My guest is Langston Hughes' biographer, Arnold Rampersad. He spent 9 years researching Hughes' life and examining the racial and political issues that inspired his poems. A New York Times book review called the biography superlative. A Los Angeles Times review called it a literary event. Rampersad is professor of English at Columbia University and the author of The Art and Imagination of W.E.B. Du Bois. The newly published second volume of his biography, The Life of Langston Hughes, covers the years from 1941 through 1967 when Hughes died at the age of 65. Let's start things off with a recording of Hughes reading his poem Weary Blues, which is inspired by a blues song he heard as a child. The poem was written in the early 1920s. This recording is from 1958 and features jazz accompaniment by a septet led by trumpeter Red Allen.
Groaning in a drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of a one-bulb light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul, oh blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world, ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock or a man that's dead.
That's Langston Hughes, and my guest is Arnold Rampersad, his biographer. Arnold Rampersad, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
You described the poem that we just heard as one of Langston Hughes' first important poems and one of the first poems that linked blues and formal poetry.
Yes, Carl Sandburg before Hughes had done something with jazz, just very briefly in, I think, Jazz Fantasies, I believe it's called. But Hughes was the first poet to, in America, in the world, really, to look seriously at black music, at jazz, at the blues, at ragtime even, and to try to fuse that poetry with, or that music, that art, with formal poetry. And that's one of his very first poems. There he encloses the blues in a formal poem later on by the end of the decade. That was written in 1923, I think. By the end of the decade, he was writing blues by themselves, as it were, just simply bowing to the musicians who had created this wonderful art form out of Afro-American experience.
Why did he write so many poems in a blues style or in dialect?
Well, in the blues style, I think he believed blues was more than just a musical style. He believed that the spirit of the blues was, if there was such a thing as one spirit of black Americans, that the blues best represented the spirit of black Americans. In other words, it was based in a sense of adversity, in a sense of suffering and tragedy, but it was converted through laughter and through the art of music. It was converted into something that was positive. It was emotion, in other words, from oppression to a kind of victory, always with laughter somewhere in the vicinity. And he thought that that amounted almost to a philosophy, if you like, of black life, and also a philosophy that that other peoples could turn to as they dealt with experience.
But his blues-inspired poems were criticized by both black and white critics. What kinds of criticisms did he get for these poems?
Well, his second book of poems, Fine Clothes to the Jew, which is very heavily a blues collection, I mean, that was absolutely savaged by the black critics. I think that they resented the fact that Hughes, in using dialect and in talking about people fighting with one another or prostitution and so on, urban malaise, despair, whatever, that he was showing the bad side of the race to white people. But more informed critics, both black and white, recognized that something really significant was being done. An important Chicago critic, later a major professor of American studies, Howard Mumford Jones, pointed out that in using the blues, Hughes really was doing an extraordinary thing. He was adding a form to English poetry, like the sonnet or the ballad form. And I think that's absolutely true. And a number of poets since the 20s down to our day, both black and white, have continued to write blues poetry.
Langston Hughes wanted to make his living as a writer. Was he the first black American writer to be able to accomplish that?
Over a long period of time, absolutely, yes. Paul Laurence Dunbar, at the turn of the century, had enjoyed a national vogue, and he did very well for a few years. But Langston believed from the time he was 1920, certainly by the time he was 23 or 24, that he was going to be a writer and that he would exist simply by his writing. He lived until 1967. He held two temporary jobs, teaching in the Chicago Lab School at one point and also at Atlanta University at another point, 3 months each. Otherwise, he simply lived by his writing. So that meant that he starved a great deal of the time, but he stuck to his path.
My guest is Arnold Rampersand, who's written a two-volume biography of Langston Hughes. The second volume has just been published. I'd like to ask you to read Hughes' very first published poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
This poem was published in 1921 in The Crisis, edited by W.B. Du Bois. The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like rivers.
Is that a poem that you especially like?
I do. I like it a great deal. It comes out of a particular moment in Hughes's life. He was going off to Mexico to join his father. His father hated the idea that his son wanted to become a poet. His father, who was black, did not like black Americans, didn't like white Americans because of the way they treated him, wanted Langston Hughes to exile himself and go after money. Hughes said that he was crossing the Mississippi in a train on the way to Mexico. He looked at the sunset, the river, and it came to him suddenly that he was a part of a noble people, no matter how much they had been oppressed, what degree of poverty so many of them existed in. And this phrase came to him: "I've known rivers. We are historical. We have depth. We have spirituality." And the poem wrote itself, according to him. We don't know if it's true, but all the evidence shows that in fact it came out of that particular moment. And it's very interesting that a poem written at 19 years of age, just about, remained, in a way, his benchmark poem. I mean, I'm sure he was being asked to read it in the very last year of his life.
You got at something that's a real paradox of Langston Hughes' early life. You mentioned that his father really disliked American blacks, and Langston Hughes really disliked his father for that.
Yes.
He didn't see his father very much when he was growing up.
No, he did not.
But also when Langston Hughes was growing up, he wasn't always exposed to that many blacks. In his high school, he was one of few blacks.
That's true. In his high school, in the school before that, where he wrote his first poem in the little town of Lincoln in Illinois, and before that in Lawrence, Kansas, where he grew up. He was very often the only, or perhaps one of two or three blacks.
Yet he wrote so many poems celebrating the black experience. Do you think that being not among that many blacks during part of his childhood made him more aware of his blackness?
Absolutely, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he was exposed to black culture, say, in the churches, and in one or two people who were very kind to him. And I think he early on identified the regard, the loving regard of black people, as something that meant a tremendous amount to him. I don't think anything meant more to him than that. But you're right. I mean, he, going on to Columbia University, he certainly did not meet any large number of blacks there. And I think he was empowered by that, the fact that he was viewing the culture to some extent inside, to a large extent from outside, made him really devoted to it.
It was in Harlem that he felt he really found his home. What brought him there?
Well, his father wanted him to go to Switzerland and study three languages and learn mining, because his father owned mines in Mexico. Langston told the father he could do the same thing at Columbia, but he really wanted to go to Harlem because in 1921, Shuffle Along, with a musical, historic musical, had just opened. People were beginning to sense that the phenomenon known as the Harlem Renaissance was on its way. Exciting things were happening in that part of the world, and he wanted to be a part of that, where the Crisis magazine, Du Bois, was James Weldon Johnson, Jesse Fawcett, any number of people were there, young Paul Robeson later on. He wanted to be a part of that, so he went off to Harlem and fell in love with it. I mean, he wandered around the world a great deal, but 1947, when he finally got a little bit of money from a musical play, he boarded a house and stayed there for the next 20 years of his life.
Would you read us one of his poems about Harlem?
This is a little poem from the 20s. It's called "Aesthete in Harlem." Strange that in this nigger place I should meet life face to face, when for years I had been seeking life in places gentler speaking, until I came to this vile street and found life stepping on my feet.
When you read one of Hughes's poems out loud, do you feel influenced at all by his own style of reading?
Well, I don't know how well he read his own poetry, and he did not have a great deal of force, and he also did not like poems, he said, read in a far-off manner, kind of stagey manner, and I think maybe I like a little bit of staginess in the reading of poetry. I like the way he reads his poems because what comes through is his humility about the poetic medium. He doesn't pretend there is more in his poem than he thinks there is. But I like hearing, say, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee read his poetry. They're wonderful at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work on the life of Langston Hughes, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Arnold Rampersand. He's a professor of English at Columbia University and the author of a 2-volume biography of Langston Hughes. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Talking about the life and poems of Langston Hughes, my guest is his biographer, Arnold Rampersad. You know, you were saying that you found Hughes's own readings lacking in a certain drama. I really like the way he reads with jazz musicians, and I think it, in a way, foreshadows some of the beat poets and the way they read their own work.
I think he was very proud of that. Carl Sandburg, of course, jumped in the 50s and said, "Oh, I was doing that a long time ago," but really, it is Langston Hughes who first made a great thing out of reading poetry to a jazz accompaniment. He saw jazz as the authentic 20th-century American music. And his poetry just seemed to go naturally along with it. And I think yes, he reads much better when he has that jazz accompaniment.
Let's play another example of him reading one of his poems with a jazz accompaniment. This is recorded in 1958. The poem is Note on Commercial Theater. And playing with him is Red Allen on trumpet, Vic Dickinson on trombone, Sam Taylor on tenor sax, Al Williams at the piano, Milt Hinton on bass, and O.C. Johnson drums.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl. You mixed them up with symphonies and you fixed them so they don't sound like me. Yep, you've done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth and Carmen Jones and all kind of swing Mikados. And in everything but what's about me. But someday somebody'll stand up and talk about me and write about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me and put on plays about me. I reckon it'll be me myself. Yes, it'll be me.
When Langston Hughes is saying, "You've taken my blues and gone," is he meaning literally himself or the work of blacks in general? And I ask that, knowing that he worked on the commercial theater and wasn't usually all that satisfied with the results.
No, he wasn't really talking about himself so much as the way in which so many aspects of American entertainment have taken parts of black culture, left the blacks behind if they could. I'm talking now historically. Converted jazz into sort of a hybrid musical form that would appeal across the board to people who themselves would not really want to have anything to do with the originators of the music, the black musicians. He's talking about that, and he's hoping that one day the blacks will be able to speak with their own true voices, that blacks will write their own literature and not simply have to read about themselves refracted through the eyes of white authors or white musicians. That poem was written in the 1940s, and perhaps the time has come.
There was an interesting tension in his work between his desire for commercial success and his interest in radical politics, and he found the two finally unreconcilable.
Yes, he did. In the 30s, I think you noticed that tension most of all, because, say, at the Caramu Playhouse in Cleveland, he is trying out plays which he, I think, hoped would come to to Broadway. At the same time, he really is in his most radical phase, 32, 33, 34. In 1938, the Harlem Suitcase Theater puts on essentially a radical play of his, Don't You Want to Be Free? Yet still, he's getting older, and he wants to make some money. He wants to have a house, finally, in his lifetime, he wants to have a house.
And, but he wants people to read his poems, and what he was finding was the people who he wanted as his audience really weren't interested in the kind of Marxist-oriented
poetry. That is absolutely
true.
I would say that the masses of black Americans, he wanted to reach them, he wanted to stay with them, and they were definitely not interested in radical socialist poetry. That certainly is true.
I was very interested in your chronicling of his reactions to the black literature of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and the reactions of black poets and novelists to Langston Hughes's work as Hughes got older.
Yes.
For instance, he didn't like Native Son. He thought the story was too sordid and that
right.
blacks needed heroes.
Yes. He felt it was the wrong time. In 1940, World War II had started, if not for the United States, for the rest of the world. But I think any time he would have found the realism, the ultra-realism of Native Son, just the depiction of its black hero as essentially a brute, that was just too much for Langston Hughes, who believed that the beauty of the people should also be pointed out. And that book, I think, does not give two sides. I respect the book profoundly, but he's right in that the book does not even suggest a possibility of a richer, more humane side to black culture. And he found the same fault with a number of later books by black writers.
In the 1960s, when there were more radical definitions of blackness and when a lot of black writers were becoming more militant in their writing, many of them really parted with Langston Hughes. He didn't necessarily like their work, and they didn't necessarily respect his accomplishments. Let me quote something that you quote, that Amiri Baraka, who is still going by the name of Leroy Jones, said in 1965. He said, "Let Langston and his ilk keep silent in the face of real artists. Theater in 1965 is not for leftover Lazaruses of the so-called Negro Renaissance."
Well, that's particularly interesting, since in the 50s, when Leroy Jones was living in the Village and Greenwich Village, and performing as an editor, sometimes as the only black, usually as the only black in a sea of white poetic voices, Langston often pressed him to take race more into account. I mean, he liked and admired Leroy Jones. He thought he was enormously talented, but he kept telling him, you have got to look at your own people and what we have done and listen to the blues and the jazz and so on. 5 years later, 6 or 7 years later, Leroy Jones has swept past Langston Hughes, but of course, we know that he has also returned in recent years back to a position much closer to Langston Hughes than he was in 1965 or 66. And he now speaks with great reverence for Langston Hughes, if only because he discovered later on that many of the positions he took subsequent to that nationalist episode were positions anticipated by Langston Hughes maybe 30 years ago. So he is among the most fervent praisers of Langston Hughes today.
You raise the question of Langston Hughes' sexuality in your book. Some people thought he was homosexual, in part because he never married and also because he frequently hung around with young, attractive men. But you suggest he was probably asexual and that there's really no evidence that he partook of many heterosexual relationships or any homosexual relationships.
Right. I encountered the rumors fairly early on, and also the beliefs that this man was homosexual. I think the sexuality of a poet, of a writer, is very important for a biographer.
Why? Because some people would think, well, that's really none of the public's business. Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I think that biography is the story of the life, and sexuality is obviously important to the life. It may not be so important to the art, and I think it's not very easy to tell from Langston Hughes's poetry his sexual persuasion. But I think the biographer really is interested in every aspect, even those that's important, even if it's not related to the art. If, for example, Langston Hughes had run for office and for some particular office that had nothing to do with poetry, it would still be important to a biographer. I tracked down this aspect of his life as best I could, as diligently as I could. I was certainly prepared to reveal anything I found that would be definitive or persuasive. Found nothing. The true story is that the man seemed to hide his sexual activity to such an extent that you have to wonder how much of it there was and why he was so determined not to let people know what he was doing in this regard. He created a family for himself toward the end of his life, but it was a family in which he, as a 40-something, 50-something, and then 60-something-year-old man, was essentially a son, because he was living with a man and woman he called aunt and uncle, who were not really related to him, but who had known him virtually all his life. So he believed in family life, that's for sure. He believed in young people. He clearly, in the 50s and 60s, saw some young men as his sons and tried to help them. But as far as I know, that was the extent to which it went.
Let me ask you to read one more Langston Hughes poem. Would you read Dream Variation?
Dream Variation is a poem that written again in his youth, about 1924, I would think. Dream Variation. To fling my arms wide in some place of the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl, till the quick day is done, rest at pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me.
When Langston Hughes died at the age of 65 in 1967, do you think that he felt that his writing had been appreciated?
I think he did. The previous year he had been to, I always forget the exact name of this gathering, but it was a gathering of Pan-African peoples, artists of the world in Dakar, put on by Léopold Sédar Senghor, the poet president of Senegal. And you had people from all over the world, blacks and whites, and he clearly was regarded as one of the founding fathers of the idea of negritude, or of soul, if you like, in a literary and artistic sense. The New York Times talked about how young writers followed him about the way in the United States youngsters would follow a baseball star about. So he knew he had left his mark on world culture, particularly where black people were concerned. Whether he felt he'd got exactly his justice, I don't know, but he was to some extent a fatalistic person. So I'm pretty certain that he believed at the end that that he had done well. He had done well, that he had lived up to the charge that his grandmother must have left him, and that was that he had to do something for the world, something that was noble, something that was good, worthwhile for the world. And he had done so.
You only have a few seconds left, but let me ask you. You must have asked yourself what Langston Hughes would have thought of your two-volume biography had he been able to read it.
I think he would have chuckled. I think he would have laughed. At his funeral, he requested that, in planning for it, requested that the last tune be a tune that Duke Ellington made famous called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. And I think he would have believed that somehow he had reached across from the grave. He had an offbeat sense of humor, and he would have been amused at some of the mistakes in the book, too, because, of course, there must be mistakes, since no biographer can possibly recover the truth either about the facts or even the spirit of the person, not the 100% truth. So somewhere I think he is laughing at the effort, but I hope he's also glad that I wrote the book.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Arnold Rampersad's two-volume biography of Langston Hughes is titled The Life of Langston Hughes. The recently published second volume covers the years from 1941 through Hughes's death in 1967. It's published by Oxford University Press. Rampersad is a professor of English at Columbia University. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with feminist social critic Ellen Willis. She writes on such subjects as religion, pornography, parenting, and rock music. She was once described as a natural dissident who's always taking unpopular positions. She's currently a senior editor at The Village Voice. I hope you can join us.
Sons of Saturn, this is what I'm going to sing. The sons of Saturn, this is what I'm going to sing. I feel the blues are coming. Wonder what the blues will bring.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Composer Rhys Chatham writes new music inspired by minimalism and hard rock. Chatham made it easier for new music composers to have their works heard when he co-founded The Kitchen in Manhattan, which became one of the country's most important performance spaces. Coming up, a talk with Rhys Chatham. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews a new recording of Bud Powell compositions as interpreted by Herb Robertson and his brass sextet. Kevin says this unusual instrumentation allows us to hear the music in a fresh way. And the King returns to help us celebrate the Valentine season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. The judge in charge of the Iran-Contra case today postponed for at least a day a decision on whether to accept an agreement negotiated over the weekend between Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh and the Bush administration on the way classified information can be used in Oliver North's trial. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
This morning, Judge Gerhard Gesell sent the jury home for at least 2 days with his apologies, explaining that he'd been ordered by the Supreme Court to halt the North trial. Gesell set tomorrow afternoon for a hearing on the compromise agreement for handling classified information. If the judge approves the agreement, the trial can go forward. If he does not, there will be further delay. The judge also declassified much of the compromise proposal worked out over the weekend. It calls for 9 categories of information that North and his lawyers could not use at trial without first notifying the government and giving it a chance to object. North's lawyers vehemently objected to the proposed agreement, saying it would disallow vital information at trial. For example, that Oliver North was put in an impossible position by top government officials. According to North, top officials of the government, including President Reagan and the Secretaries of State and Defense, knew and were involved in arranging for third countries to help the Contras. And North was told not to disclose this information at the same time he was told not to lie. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Budget Director Richard Darman went to Capitol Hill today to meet with Democratic Budget Chairman and the House Majority Leader. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports that the lengthy session dealt only with procedure.
Democrats in Congress have been complaining that the president's budget message last week talked about where more money would be spent, but not where the cuts to pay for new programs would come from. After meeting for an hour and a half with Budget Director Darman, House Budget Committee Chairman Leon Panetta, Senate Budget Committee Chairman Jim Sasser, and House Majority Leader Thomas Foley are still in the dark on the specific budget cuts President Bush endorses. The men described their meeting as fruitful and productive, where the tone was conciliatory and friendly. They insisted that this could not be described as a negotiating session or the preliminaries of a budget summit. Instead, it was simply a discussion of where to go from here. The answer, tomorrow, the budget chairman and Darman will meet with staff experts to get a thorough briefing on the Bush budget before starting public hearings next week. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Secretary of State James Baker today said discussions will continue between Bonn and Washington on modernization of NATO's short-term nuclear weapons, rather short-range nuclear weapons. The subject was the main topic of talks Baker held today in 3 European capitals. Deidre Berger has more from Bonn.
At a press conference tonight, Secretary of State James Baker said his talks in Bonn demonstrated the strength of the U.S.-German relationship. But on the difficult issue of modernization, Baker said he and West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl agreed to continue talks in the hopes a decision can be taken at the next NATO summit meeting. The U.S. and Britain are pressing for an early decision, but Kohl says he would prefer for NATO to wait until 1991 or 92 before making the decision. During short side trips to Copenhagen and Oslo today, Baker was also advised by Scandinavian leaders not to pressure West Germany into a decision. Tomorrow, Baker continues his week-long European trip with stops in Turkey, Greece, and Italy. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Bonn.
A construction firm is challenging a requirement in Boston that a percentage of the work on government projects be reserved for minority-owned firms. The suit filed today by the Fairview Construction Company is believed to be the first since the Supreme Court last month ruled against a minority set-aside program in Richmond, Virginia. Stock prices were lower today in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 3 points to close at 2282.50. Declines led advances 7-5. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist Bud Powell was one of the key innovators of the bebop movement of the 40s, and he composed and performed on and off until his death in 1966. Herb Robertson is a Brooklyn-based trumpeter who's arranged Powell's music for brass band. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's an unlikely idea, but one that works.
That's Bud Powell as jazz folk usually think of him, the piano virtuoso who combines saxophonist Charlie Parker's twisting bebop lines with the spare off-center bass work of pianist Earl Hines. By forging a synthesis of Parker and Hines, Bud Powell became the most influential jazz piano player of the last 40 years. But he was more than a great pianist. This is the music of Bud Powell, too. That's Bud Powell's composition, Un Poco Loco, literally, A Little Crazy. It was arranged by trumpeter Herb Robertson and played by his brass ensemble, a sextet with two trumpets, French horn, trombone, tuba, and drums. They're heard on a new album, Shades of Bud Powell, on the JMT label. Herb Robertson set out to honor Powell's writing rather than his playing. He's done it by recasting his compositions for a band that neither includes piano nor uses Bud's tunes as springboards for far-flung solos. Robertson divorces Powell's music from its usual context so we can hear it with a fresh ear. The process is a little like translating a poem from one language into another. For example, Bud Powell's version of Glass Enclosure gently mocked the excesses of some overheated classical pianists. Herb Robertson translates Glass Enclosure into a brass band march that keeps putting off its grand finale. He uses a different idiom to poke fun at the same sort of musical pomp. Thank you. There's some fine solo work on this album. The dark tones of French horn player Vincent Chancy and trombonist Robin Eubanks give the sextet a robust sound. Bob Stewart's tuba syncopations and Joey Barron's finely textured drumming keep the music swinging. But the album is more of a showcase for the band as a whole than for individual players. The solos fit into a larger compositional plan. Trumpeter Robertson does allow himself one feature, The Fruit, arranged for trumpet, tuba, and percussion. Powell's theme sounds more lyrical uncoiling on Robertson's muted horn than it does when played on piano. Bud Powell had a difficult life. His troubled final years helped inspire the movie Round Midnight, Bertrand Tavernier's sentimental portrait of a dying jazz man. One of the best things about Herb Robertson's tribute to Powell is that he doesn't play up the tragic cliches. Instead, he emphasizes the clarity, charm, and sense of fun in Bud Powell's writing. He makes us rethink the music and the man.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Herb Robertson's new album, Shades of Bud Powell, on the JMT label. This is Fresh Air. Composer Rhys Chatham says he writes new age music for heavy metal fans. His compositions are influenced both by minimalism and hard rock. He's a classically trained composer who studied as a teenager with electronic composer Morton Subotnick and later with minimalist Lamont Young. Chatham also contributed to new music by co-founding The Kitchen in 1971. It became one of the country's most important performance spaces. Twice he served as The Kitchen's music director. Chatham lives in Paris now, but he returns to The Kitchen this week for a retrospective of his work. We invited him to Fresh Air for a mini-retrospective. The music we'll hear is from his latest album, Die Dunner Gutter, which features compositions from 1977 to 1986. This is Chatham's 1977 piece, Guitar Trio. First of your compositions that started mixing rock and avant-garde music, what elements of each did you want to bring together?
Well, there was a whole thing happening in the 60s and 70s with composers feeling that they were in an ivory tower, that they were doing music that was elitist. So there were a number of people, Frederick Chesky, for example, Garrett List, were making an effort to make their music more accessible to a larger audience. Terry Raleigh would fall into that category too, Lamont Young, Steve Reich, Phil Glass. Where Frederick Chesky and Garrett were working more with jazz elements in their compositions, I was interested in mixing rock with what I was doing as a minimalist composer.
Now, you had come from an avant-garde classical background. Had you been listening to rock a lot before starting to work with it?
Not very much. As a teenager, I was listening mostly to Stockhausen, Boulez, Edgar Varèse.
Mm-hmm.
people like that. I didn't go to a concert, a rock concert, until I was about 24.
Mm-hmm. What was the concert?
Well, my friend Peter Gordon, who's also a composer, took me to see the Ramones at CBGB's.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, my gosh, this is not unsimilar to what I'm doing as a minimalist.
Well, what connection did you see?
Well, they were working with three chords, mm-hmm. 1, 4, 5. I was working with one chord, but I thought it wasn't unsimilar, and I certainly liked the drive that the music had. And I thought that maybe I could do something in this direction also.
Let's go to a piece that you wrote in 1986. So this is pretty recent. This is called Waterloo Number 2. It's for solo percussionist, three trumpets, two trombones, and keyboard. And my guest, Rhys Chatham, is featured on trumpet. Let's hear a little bit of it. Times I hear that, the catchier it becomes. I've always really had an affection for military music and drum and bugle corps kind of stuff. What do you like about it?
Well, with the rock pieces that I made, I was interested in working with a non-notated sort of music. Around about 1982, I became interested in working with notated music.
And that was a new direction for you, notated music.
Yes, I wanted to get the same kind of drive that I got with my rock pieces through notated music, and I thought that Marshall music might be a good way to go about this.
Now, you moved from guitar to working with brass for a while. What was in back of that change?
Well, I had experienced massive hearing loss from my work with the guitar bands.
Mm-hmm.
I've been touring all around Europe and around America, and I got back from a tour, and I couldn't hear a thing. And there was ringing in my ears, and I thought, my goodness, it's time to take a little rest. And that's the reason I decided I wanted to play a quieter instrument. So I took up the trumpet.
Did your hearing return?
It took 2 years, but then it got better. And now I have most of my hearing back and I'm playing guitar again.
Playing loud again?
What?
Are you... really, though, would you go to listen or play in a really loud concert now?
For a couple of years, I couldn't, but now I'm playing at the same volume levels that I was playing in 82.
How come you went back to that since it hurt your hearing so much?
Because in the 70s and the 80s, and even now, I'm using as a primary vocabulary the overtone series that's generated by the strings of electric guitar. Overtones are very delicate things, and they're hard for a lot of people to hear. So what I have to do is turn up the fundamental in order to hear the overtones with the clarity that I want to hear, which is why I like to play at these loud volume levels, even though it makes me go deaf.
Hmm. Well, let's hear a piece that you wrote over the two-year period of 1984 to 1986.
Mm-hmm.
This is Die Diner Gutter for six electric guitars, electric bass, and drums, and my guest Rhys Chatham is conducting. This piece starts at the dramatic threshold of a climax, and it just stays there a while. It makes, you know, to listen to it stay at that peak for a sustained period really creates, I think, a lot of tension in the listener, because you're waiting for it to break, and it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. It starts off with a three-minute climax. I thought it would be interesting to put that climax at the beginning rather than at the end.
Why?
For fun.
Uh-huh.
But then as we listen to the piece, what I was exploring in it mainly was working with melody in a way that I hadn't worked with melody before. With Guitar Trio, the primary melodic interest is in the overtones that are generated by the electric guitar. But in Die Diner Gutter, we're working right on the fretboard, making these melodies, which was a big step forward for us.
Maybe I'll play a little part here that shows off the melody.
Okay.
Thank you. special tunings on this piece, right?
Yes, I do.
It's interesting to me that when you started to work professionally, you were a harpsichord tuner.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to know precise and accurate tunings. and now you're really messing around with tunings a lot.
It's been the basis of my work for the past 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, I was studying with Lamont Young, who's interested in just intonation. I used to tune his piano for him. And so I was working in just intonation also. It was a very beautiful tuning. But since then, I've been working in equal temperament and mean tone in all different kinds of tuning. I even did a piece called The Out-of-Tune Guitar.
Where are you now in your composing? Are you working on any brand new ideas for you?
Yes. Well, I'm playing a lot of trumpet now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a new band that's inspired by acid house music. Well, what I was interested in doing in the late 60s and early 70s was making my music more accessible. I think what I'm interested in doing now is making it more elitist.
Why? Would you want to do that?
Maybe what I should say is more complex. I'm interested in taking the vocabulary that composers have been developing during this century and putting more and more of them into my music, not just the rock elements, not just the minimalist elements, but what about chance operations? What about randomly generated numbers? What about the ideas of the futurists in the early part of this century? How can we put those things together in a new and different way? We're in a very interesting time for art music at the moment. I mean, during the 50s, if you're a hip composer, you'd be writing surrealist music. You'd be writing music in a modernist vein. During the 60s and 70s, you'd be writing process music. You'd be writing minimalism. Now there's no critical theory with any consensus. There's no particular style that or bandwagon to jump on. And that's what's so exciting about this time.
I think it's a nice thing about this time.
Exactly.
Because there aren't people trying to fit themselves into a particular style in that respect.
And as long as it can go on that way, the happier I'll be.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us, and I wish you the best at your retrospective at the Kitchen. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rhys Chatham's retrospective at the Kitchen runs from Thursday through Saturday. His latest album, Die Dunnergutter, is distributed by New Music Distribution Service in New York. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, what's coming up?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about the status of the Oliver North trial. We should be learning tomorrow when perhaps the trial will be held. We'll also be hearing about home health care and why it has won the approval of many who figure in the equation of providing health care. And we'll be talking to the Surgeon General of the U.S., C. Everett Koop, on how he seems to have managed to maintain his principles and the influence of the office while being Surgeon General of the United States. And Vera Frankel reports from London on 10 years of the guardian angels in that city.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Flowers and chocolates and cards that say I love you are the norm for Valentine's Day, but we've got something that's a little more paranormal.
I'm going to Graceland. Yeah, a little more echo on the voice there, man. I'm going to Graceland. Yeah, a little more echo on the voice there, man.
How's that, Elvis?
Sounds good.
Hey, wait a minute, fellas. Got this interview to do. You know, Terry Gross from Fresh Air. Hey, good to see you, baby. Don't trip over the casket, huh?
So, Elvis, yeah. Tell us, what did you come back for?
Well, Terry, a lot of people ask me that question. And, you know, this is the time of year of hearts and flowers, of cards and candy. And maybe I can best answer that question in a little song. You know, I had to come back from the dead on this Valentine's Day just to say I love you. Well, Terry, what do you think of the concept?
It's tasteless.
Yeah?
It's pointless. It's pretty good.
Glad you like it. I'm looking for sort of wider exposure, you know? All these public radio stations are just too hard to tune in. All down here in the bottom of the dial, the FM ghetto.
In the ghetto, and though my antenna is 40 miles high, I still can't get WHYY. In the FM ghetto.
What do you think of the new songs, the contemporary sound?
Well, I'm very glad you asked me that question, Terry. I'm quiet, boy. Because I'm working on some new material. The contemporary sound, you might call it, but still in the unmistakable style of the king.
Oh, well, here's a little
sing a note for note. I know it sounds corny and a little bit sappy, but don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, don't worry, be happy. Hey man, look at me, I'm dead and I'm happy. Uh-huh.
Quiet down, White Fang.
Elvis, what's with the dog?
I'm anchoring a local newscast, and my producer, Soupy Sales, lent me this dog as a co-host.
Good evening. I'm Elvis, and what's happening tonight, White Fang? Oh, you got a joke for us. All right, and who's there? Razor Gorbachev who? You killed me, White Fang. You killed me.
Okay, well, Elvis, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, gotta run anyway, Terry. Gotta pick myself up a copy of my favorite Elvis movie, King Creole, down at the VCR store. You know that picture was directed by the same man who directed Casablanca?
Play it, Sam. Play Viva Las Vegas.
I'm a little rusty, Mr. Elvis. I don't remember it no more.
You can play it for her, you can play it for me, man. How about Hunk of Burning Love?
No way.
Return to Sender?
Uh-uh.
Do the Clan?
No can do.
Suspicious Minds?
Mm-mm.
Well, Terry, let me wish you and everybody else out there a whole lot of love this Valentine's Day season. You know, I got a reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland, whatever that means. Got to get back to Memphis now.
Okay, Scotty.
Elvis's return was staged by Robert Kaplow and the Punsters and produced by Tim Corzin.
For reasons I cannot explain, there's some part of me wants to see Graceland. And I may be obliged to defend every love, every ending, or maybe there's no obligations now. Maybe I'm a reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, David Levitt talks about writing novels about the family from a gay perspective. Our rock historian Ed Ward profiles country music star Charlie Rich. And John Leonard reviews the book causing riots in India and Pakistan, Satanic Verses, by Indian writer Salman Rushdie. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.